some gold in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Laurie Mercier speaks with Juan Cole in an update to the 2014 interview with Cole that aired again recently here on KBOO on the Old Mole. Then the problem with polls, part two. Patricia Kohlberg reads more from Samuel Earle. Jan Hawken and Denise Morris review the comedy drama Primary Colors from 1998. And finally, Patricia Kohlberg speaks with Michaela McCormick about saving our planet from climate catastrophe and the new documentary Outgrow the System. First up, Laurie Mercier speaks with Middle East specialist Juan Cole about Israel's wars and the response from American college students and the Biden administration. Here's Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Good morning. I'm speaking with Juan Ricardo Cole, the Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan and specialist in Islamic, Arabic, Middle Eastern, and North African studies. He's the author of over a dozen books, including his most recent, Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires, and other books, including The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East and Engaging the Muslim World. Cole is a public intellectual, prominent blogger, and prolific essayist. You can find much of his work on the important website Informed Comment. Welcome back to KBOO, Juan Cole.
Thank you, Laura.
In 2014, we had you on the show to talk about Israel's seven-week bombardment of Gaza. Less than a decade later, no one could anticipate the horrific live stream genocide and massive destruction of the past year. But when I say no one could anticipate, do you think Netanyahu was waiting for an October 7th opportunity to advance a plan to destroy Gaza and accelerate displacement and departure of Palestinians?
I think that Benjamin Netanyahu is a pragmatist. If he needs to make an alliance with the Labor Party, he does. He's had them in his cabinets. In order to get back into power in 2022, he had to make an alliance with the Israeli equivalent of the Proud Boys, the extremist, far-right, racist, fascist elements, which had been a red line for Israeli politics. But Netanyahu brought them in. He made Etamar Ben-Gavir the Minister of National Security, and made Bezalel Smotrich Minister of Finance, but gave him a portfolio of responsibility for the civil administration of the Palestinian West Bank. Both are settlers themselves. They're squatters on Palestinian land beyond the borders of Israel. And so I think that, Netanyahu is an opportunist. Where he thinks he could get away with something, he would do it. He does belong to the far-right Likud party, which is not quite as far-right, but really far-right compared to anything else, as the religious Zionists and the Jewish power blocks. And he, back in the Trump administration, he at one point wanted to annex formally part of the Palestinian West Bank and said that, Trump is in and we have an opportunity to do this. It never went through. But he has his eye out for these opportunities to liquidate the Palestinians, to grab more of their land, to crowd them out. And I think, it's not that there's a master plan, but that where an opportunity arises that one could, where the Israelis could diminish the Palestinian presence, could grab more land from them, could crowd them out possibly entirely, they would go for it.
Now that Israel has completely destroyed Gaza, it has turned to Lebanon ostensibly to crush Hezbollah. Biden and Blinken continue to claim Israel has a right to defend itself as they offer faint appeals for humanitarian considerations. What does Israel have to gain from this assault on Lebanon? Given its past history in attacking Lebanon, does it seriously believe it can remake the Middle East?
Yes, I think that Netanyahu believes this is a moment where he has complete backing from the United States and where he can reshape the Israeli security environment. From Israel's point of view, their security situation is not ideal. Although they got a separate peace with Egypt, which was the biggest and most threatening of the Arab armies, and a peace deal with Jordan, they still have hostile relations with Syria, and they have hostile relations with southern Lebanon in the form of Hezbollah, and also of the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon who were expelled by the Israelis in 1948, and who have a long history of going across the border and attacking Israel, either with guerrilla actions or with rockets. At the moment, tens of thousands of Israeli residents of northern Israel have been forced from their homes, and this is true from the beginning of the Gaza war, when Hezbollah took Hamas's side and began increasing its rocket fire at Israel in support of Hamas. This is just unacceptable to the Israeli government. They want freedom of action. If they feel they need to go into Gaza, they want to be able to go into it without being harassed from the rear by Hezbollah from Lebanon. So they are taking this opportunity to attempt to severely attrite Hezbollah's capabilities. I think ultimately a diplomatic deal could be done of the sort that was done in 2006, where a cold peace could be arranged, where the Hezbollah would agree not to fire its rockets into Israel and would move away from the Israeli-Lebanese border. That, of course, would please Netanyahu if Netanyahu could get another buffer zone inside Lebanon, occupy part of Lebanon, as the Israelis did from 1982 to 2000. That would please Netanyahu if they could find a way to occupy enough Lebanese territory so that they would get access to Lebanese rivers and could siphon the water off towards Israel. That would please Netanyahu as well. So there could be several goals in this campaign, but one of them would be to neutralize Hezbollah as a security factor for Israel, at least in the medium term.
And do you think that's likely to happen?
I'm not very good at predicting the future. I think it's certainly possible that a 2006 style diplomatic resolution of this particular war on the Lebanese front could happen. You should remember that Lebanon is a multicultural society, has a substantial number of Christians, of Sunni Arabs, and the Shiites in the south are not all Hezbollah supporters. Hezbollah is a primarily Shiite party, but it has a rival in the form of Amal, and usually splits seats in parliament with Amal. So the other forces in Lebanon are not happy about being dragged into a war with Israel, especially since Israel is targeting facilities, buildings, even civilians, beyond the Shiites, beyond the Hezbollah, what the press calls the Hezbollah strongholds, which is a huge misnomer, because you can't assume that a Shiite neighborhood is necessarily a pro-Hezbollah. And even if it were, it's not a warrant to wipe out the civilians who live there. But in any case, these other forces in Lebanon will be putting pressure on Hezbollah to cool it, and will be reaching out to the United States and Europe, perhaps to the Gulf, to try to find a way of negotiating an end to this round of fighting.
You've pointed out in a column in Common Dreams that U.S. efforts in the region have been undermined by its breathtaking hypocrisy, and that the Biden administration is wearing the same blinkers that once blinded LBJ and his advisors as they accelerated the Vietnam War. So how is the United States becoming drawn into this larger conflict?
Well, President Biden's main foreign policy initiative up until October 7th of last year had been to organize Europe to resist the Russian occupation of part of Ukraine on the grounds that the Russia's invasion of Ukraine and occupation of the Donbas and other regions contravened the United Nations Charter, which forbids acquisition of territory by military means, and under the Geneva Convention of 1949, which governs how populations in occupied territories are treated during a war, and Russia was violating the Geneva Convention's provisions. These provisions have been incorporated into the Rome Statute, which is the charter for the International Criminal Court, a body of international humanitarian law that the court has jurisdiction over and has been signed on to by 124 of the world's countries. And the U.S. actually, although it always refused to sign the Rome Statute, Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, I think very cynically appealed to the International Criminal Court to indict Vladimir Putin for war crimes, and it actually did so. The ICC delivered a warrant against Putin in the spring of 2023. Which Blinken and the Biden administration hailed as a wonderful development. But of course, Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories that it seized in 1967 is illegal. It has been declared illegal by the International Court of Justice, which is the United Nations court that adjudicates issues among UN member states. And so Israel is guilty not only of an illegal occupation, just as Russia is in the Ukraine, but also of committing gross violations of the laws governing occupied territories, and of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza and in the Palestinian West Bank. To be consistent, the U.S. would have to condemn Netanyahu as forcefully as it condemned Vladimir Putin. It has not. It has made excuses for Netanyahu. It has skated around the edges of the law. It has buried internal State Department documents that found that Israel is violating U.S. law and ought not to receive further weaponry. And it has defended Israel repeatedly in the course of these atrocities. So, you know, from the point of view of the rest of the world, when Biden comes to India or to Latin America or to Africa, and says, we want you to boycott Putin. We want you to boycott the Russian economy because of their occupation policies in Ukraine. People fall down laughing, and they decline to sign on. Almost nobody outside of the NATO countries has signed on to the Russian boycott, and therefore it has failed to crash the Russian economy as the U.S. had hoped. Even Israel has not signed on to it, but virtually no U.S. partners outside of NATO have joined this effort. And one of the reasons is that it's very difficult for the rest of the world to take the U.S. stance on Ukraine and Palestine seriously. They clearly see the vast contradiction and the hypocrisy. And so I think it has undermined Biden's Ukraine effort.
I would think, especially in the Middle East, undermining any support for the United States. This is Lori Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm speaking with Professor Juan Cole about Israel's war on Gaza and Lebanon. Professor Cole, let's talk about American resistance to U.S. policies. Over the past year, we've seen hundreds of protests across the country, especially on college campuses. Students, including many Jewish students, have been leading protests and divestment efforts. But university administrators have tried to shut these down with a ferocity that we've not seen with other protest movements. What drives this determination to shut down protest and speech about Gaza?
Well, I think university administrators see what's going on in the Middle East through a very particular lens, and their discourse would be very similar to that of the Biden administration that characterizes what's going on as Israel's right to defend itself. The students see very clearly, in a way that their elders often do not, that these are war crimes that are being committed, crimes against humanity. Perhaps it's being adjudicated, but perhaps genocide, and are outraged that the university administrators, who, again, all the universities in the United States boycotted Russia. They divested from Russian firms. Their presidents denounced Vladimir Putin in no uncertain terms. So the students say, well, you did that with regard to Russia. Why won't you do it with regard to Netanyahu? The administrators don't really have a good answer for that. And in fact, now at my university and others, the administrations are adopting a neutrality policy to get them out of having to say anything about world affairs. But this is precisely in order not to have to say anything about what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. I think that these student protests against what Israel is doing in Palestine are multivalent. You know, they threaten lots of different potential interests. They threaten the U.S. establishment, which is, views Israel as a kind of a bulwark for U.S. security in the Middle East, as a kind of aircraft carrier for American operations in the Middle East, and which very much wants to preserve that functionality, and so doesn't want to damage Israel by divesting. I think there's a latent white nationalism in the United States, which became clear with the rise of Trumpism, and from which the Democratic Party is not immune either. And I think that in contemporary United States, the Israelis are coded as the whites and as facing barbarian hordes. So there's a knee-jerk support of them, which translates into the views of some of the white suburbanites about Detroit and Michigan. There's a substantial Jewish community in the United States and in universities, many of whom were brought up to identify with Israel. About two-thirds or four-fifths of Jewish Americans say that they're emotionally invested in Israel. And I've seen them, you know, students actually have tears in their eyes at seeing Israel criticized. And I think for some Jewish Americans, that Israel is a vehicle for ego inflation. Their whole identity is wrought up with it, and it becomes a sacred cow. It becomes sacrosanct. There's a question: can you criticize Israel? There isn't such a question about any other country in the world. I mean, we have millions of Mexican Americans in the United States. Nobody ever, you know, brings up the question of whether it's all right to criticize Mexico. Does that make you anti-Latino? And then there is this, I think, deeply dishonest and completely illegitimate attempt to identify criticism of Israeli policy with internal domestic anti-Semitism, which are very different phenomena. Anti-Semitism is a plague. It's a scourge on society. And it should be denounced and fought against everywhere it rears its ugly head. But protesting what Netanyahu is doing in Gaza has nothing to do with Judaism. And I think the same protests would be there and have been there in other instances of governments acting in unlawful ways against defenseless populations.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Juan Cole. Listeners can find Juan Cole's recent work many places, especially Informed Comment, Common Dreams, The Nation, Salon.com, and Foreign Policy in Focus. Thanks again.
Thank you, Lori.
What do you want the world to look like? What do you want it to be? Do you know that the wall has two sides and nobody is free? Did your mama come from Mexico? Papa come from Palestine? Sneaking all through Syria, crossing all the border lines. Let other people in. Listen to your women. Stop killing black children. Make America great again. Let other people in. Listen to your women. Stop killing black children. Make America great again. Da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-da-da-da. Da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-da-da-da. Da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-da-da-da. Da-dum, da-da-dum. Make America great again. Da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-da-da-da. Da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-da-da-da. Da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-da-da-da. Da-dum, da-da-dum.
Pussy Riot here on KBOO Community Radio. That followed Lori Mercier talking with Juan Cole for the Old Mall Variety Hour. Up next, Patricia Kohlberg reads the New York Review of Books from a review by Samuel Earle called The Problem with Polls. Stay tuned for Patricia Kohlberg next for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
Let other people in. Listen to your women. Stop killing black children. Let other people in. Listen to your women. Stop killing black children. Make America great again. Da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-da-da-da. Da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-da-da-da. Da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-da-da-da. Da-dum, da-da-dum. Make America great again. Da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-da-da-da. Da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-da-da-da. Da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-da-da-da.
Good morning. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and last week on The Old Mole, I read excerpts from an article titled The Problem with Polls by Samuel Earle, published in the New York Review of Books on October 17. Earle reviews a book by polling apologist G. Elliot Morris called Strength in Numbers, How Polls Work and Why We Need Them. The first part of the article is about how polls operate as an anti-democratic force within the body politic. Today, I'm going to read excerpts from Earle's conclusion, where he takes up the mutually self-serving relationship between polls and the press, and how social media threatens to overtake polling as a reflection of public opinion. Earle writes, Morris concedes that overall polling has yet to live up to its lofty promises, but his reasons for why polls don't work are even less convincing than his reasons for why they do. His main targets for blame are not pollsters or their methods, but the public and, above all, the press. According to Morris, the public has failed to appreciate that every poll comes with a margin of error, so really no poll can be wrong. But Morris saves his harshest words for the media. The polling industry and the media have always had a difficult, if also mutually dependent, relationship. From the start, the pollster's most important client was the press, and the two quickly established symbiotic ties. The press commissioned polls to generate news stories and bolstered its reporting with persuasive statistics, while polls relied on the press for funding and, crucially, publicity. This partnership inevitably affected the nature and purpose of polls. Newspapers wanted engaging, dramatic stories, tales of conflict and controversy. The polling industry obliged and received not just money and publicity, but an alibi. The media could now be blamed for its worst traits, exaggerating social conflict, simplifying issues, and overstating accuracy. Gallup and Roper were always skeptical of election forecasts, but election forecasts are the only verifiable theory that this science puts forward. Their accuracy is fact-checked by the final ballot in a way that other opinion polls never can be. The results are twofold: an inordinate number of polling companies participating in the game of predicting elections, on the one hand, and on the other, a huge investment in election forecasting over opinion measuring methods. Polls may have once promised to make politics about more than elections, but in practice, they have surely done the opposite. And, like advertising, political polls are increasingly associated with attempts to manipulate public opinion, tailor messaging in superficial ways, and inform public relations strategies. In the 1990s, a new technology replaced polling as the tool destined to transform democracy: the internet. In a fuller realization of polling's potential, people would be able to speak up and share their opinions at all times, leading to a better informed public, more responsive governments, and a truer version of democracy for all. Soon, a specific kind of website became the medium for these hopes and dreams: the social media platform, Facebook and Twitter in particular. Social media platforms arrived at the same convenient conclusions as the polling industry. Healthy markets and healthy democracies needed the same thing: to know what the public thinks. But surveys were no longer necessary. Through social media, users' thoughts and actions could be tracked at all times. If the topic is of interest, then the material is already there, one industry insider enthused. Thus is born the age of listening, as opposed to the age of questioning. What the advertising industry celebrated as listening, however, others saw as something more sinister. The digital economy, premised on the invasion of privacy, was soon denounced as surveillance capitalism. Information became its lifeblood, and digital companies developed insatiable appetites for more and more information on users, however trivial. Social media companies assure the public that their ravenous hunger for opinions simply stems from their deeply felt desire to give people a voice. But what they really want is reaction, a like, a share, an emoji, a short comment, or some other form of quantifiable communication that can be packaged, analyzed, and sold. In this monetized vision of the town square, more talk means more profit. Today, the product of polling remains overwhelmingly popular. Polls saturate election coverage, turn politics into a spectator sport, and provide an illusion of control over complex, unpredictable, and fundamentally fickle social forces. But the time for celebrating polls as a bastion of democracy, or as a means of bringing elites closer to voters, is surely over. The polling industry continues to boom. Democracy isn't faring quite so well. Silicon Valley ultimately peddled the same feel-good story about democracy as the polling industry, that the powerful are unresponsive to the wider public because they cannot hear their voices. If only they could hear them, then of course they would listen and act. The virtue of this diagnosis is that structural inequalities in wealth and power are left intact. All that matters in democracy is that everyone has a voice, regardless of background. In a very narrow, technical sense, their innovations have made this a reality, but the result is a loud, opinionated, and impotent public sphere, coarsened by social and economic divisions and made all the more disillusioned by the discovery that, in politics, it takes more than a voice to be heard. That was excerpts from the conclusion to an article by Samuel Earle, published in the New York Review of Books, October 17. A link to the full article is posted on the page for this show at kboo.fm. I'm Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
KBOO Community Radio with delight following Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Jan Hawken and Denise Morris review Primary Colors up next through the lens of gender politics, both now and in 1998 when the film was released. Based on the book and the Clinton 92 presidential campaign, the film is written and directed by Elaine May and Mike Nichols. Here's Jan Hawken and Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Jack Stanton, played by John Travolta, a more than Clinton-esque United States governor of a southern state, is on the presidential primary campaign trail. Jack is surrounded by aides, advisors, fixers, his ambitious wife, Susan, played by Emma Thompson, and a whole lot of scandal. But Jack Stanton has a way about him, and he uses that southern comfort as a means to distract the public into believing that he deeply cares about their problems. Young Henry Burton, played by Adrian Lester, is a political idealist and grandson of a famous civil rights leader. At film's open, Henry finds himself seduced by the candidate's warmth and empathy, in spite of his misgivings about joining the campaign. Henry's ride is our ride as we travel the country campaigning, dodging scandal, and navigating the moral booby traps that come with the desire to win by any means necessary. Directed by Mike Nichols with a screenplay by longtime collaborator Elaine May, Primary Colors is derived from the 1996 novel by Joe Klein. The novel was originally published as anonymous and is a fictional recounting of the Clinton primary campaign in 1992. Primary Colors was released in 1998 at the tail end of the Clinton administration, itself marred by a torrent of scandal and impeachment proceedings. The novel at the time was widely read, and there was a lot of fanfare around the release of Primary Colors, the film. In his 1998 review, Roger Ebert described Primary Colors as, quote, a superb film, funny, insightful, and very wise about the realities of political life. A, quote, grown-up film about real issues in the real world. Well, it is now 2024, and with the primaries long over, Election Day is here. And this morning on The Old Mole, we discuss this widely praised 26-year-old film. The actual Clinton presidency has come and gone, but the residue of that administration contributed greatly to the rise of neoconservatism, right-wing populism, Trumpism, and the MAGA movement of today. But we promise, we picked Primary Colors because we wanted to turn down the heat a bit and have some fun. So, Jan, this film is billed as a comedy drama written by Elaine May and directed by Mike Nichols, both of them longtime collaborators. They're well known for films like Birdcage, for one. They do have a long history writing comedy. Mike Nichols directed Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? He directed The Graduate. Elaine May, Heaven Can Wait, again, Birdcage, and a film that's maybe lesser known called The Heartbreak Kid. So they had a longtime collaboration. They worked in comedy. And we both thought that it is a good film. It's held up well enough, would you say?
Yeah, I think it was a solid piece of political satire, and particularly sexual politics and American-style campaigning. And we can certainly see over the decades how the right wing in this country has lost its political virginity, is not only in the position of exposing sexual scandals among liberals, some of which are based on prejudices, such as outing gay politicians, but also welcoming and embracing wholeheartedly convicted sexual predators, such as Donald Trump.
Yes, we've come a long way, haven't we?
Yeah, they've come a long way and kind of shown their true colors, their primary colors. This film interested me because there's so much to unpack around the idea of a sexual scandal and how it both boosts and defeats a political campaign, particularly a national campaign. And I think Bill Clinton was a distinctive political candidate because as a white guy from the South, governor of Arkansas, he really appropriated Southern blackness. And it's interesting how he could do that, be described even by Toni Morrison as the first black president for his love of jazz, his love of junk food, and kind of his working class roots growing up poor. But interestingly enough, our actual first black president, Obama, and our soon-to-be first woman black president, Kamala Harris, could never have the kind of sexual incontinence or even project sexuality in the way Bill Clinton did. That actual black politicians have to be extremely scrupulous about their sexual behavior because they can't indulge in the kind of stereotypes of black sensuality that Bill Clinton himself exuded. It's interesting how race and sexuality kind of intersect in the political life of this country and the political imaginary of this country.
Right. And the film does begin with the introduction of Henry. He's the son of the famous civil rights leader. And the film introduces race really immediately, and it shows Jack Stanton with Black Americans, regular folks. You know, he's got his friends who own the rib joint. They go there regularly. They seem to spend a lot of time in that restaurant. They put him in places where he is shown to have compassion for the plight of Black people. There's an early scene where they go to a literacy program and they talk with folks who are waitresses and they work in security or they work in construction, and they're all talking about how this literacy program has helped them and lifted them up. And then, of course, Jack Stanton, as Bill Clinton was able to do as well, uses stories from his life to make those connections and to build the relationship and to really demonstrate his true compassion, quote unquote, let's say, for the plight of folks who are from racially oppressed groups.
Yeah, and he was big on public education. Education and healthcare were important parts of his early campaigning and his political platform. He did, after losing an election for governor, come back with being an important spokesperson for the New Democrats, as they were called, moving to the right. And I think the many seductions of Bill Clinton were very much on display in the film, not only by the exposés around his affairs and sexual seductions on the side, but how he seduced in New Hampshire a group of union members who were distressed about the loss of jobs in this country, you know, the rise of neoliberalism in the late 20th century and the free trade agreements that many workers in manufacturing jobs suffered under. And he gives this speech to these union members saying, "I'm not going to lie to you. The economy in the world is different now. Those jobs are not coming back. But I promise you, if you work hard and go back to school, I will be there with you to find your place in the new economy. And that was kind of the core of Clinton's politics, was personal responsibility. He signed one of the most conservative Republican-sponsored welfare reform bills in history in the 90s that made work a requirement for welfare for many people. I remember when he came to actually give the commencement address in 1998 at Portland State University, which was kind of a big thing, having the president of the country come. And many of the faculty and students didn't stand up when he came onto the podium because of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. Well, Johanna Brenner and I were both on the faculty there, and we didn't stand, but not because of the Lewinsky scandal, but because of his reactionary welfare policies that were so terrible for particularly working class and poor women. But I think that the seductions in this film were kind of twofold. One was the folksy style that ushered in this new, sexier form of Democratic politicians, and also the ways in which sexual scandals seduce us into looking the other way around the policy positions, Democrats particularly.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting in the film, of course, scandal management is really the driver of the film, and it creates these moral dilemmas for both the Henry character and the Libby character, who's played outstandingly by Kathy Bates. She does such a great job, and she's fitting because she's a very strong kind of drama and comedy actress. But we get this sense of the policy from the dialogue in the film, which they're doing a very more fictionalized version of the novel. And there's been a lot of talk about the softening of some of what is in the actual novel versus what comes out in the film. But there isn't a lot of focus on the actual policies. And as you pointed out, Bill Clinton's policies, he may have been considered by Toni Morrison as the greatest Black president we've ever had, but he was also considered the greatest Republican president we've ever had. As you mentioned, the welfare reform bill, but also the crime bill and NAFTA. So those policies that he enacted were damaging to the constituents that he woos, both in the real campaign and in the film. Those folks come out on the raw end. And I think, as I mentioned in the intro, those policies resonate in the movements now, the reactionary movements, the conservative right populist movements in this country, because people did lose their jobs and they did not come back. And Clinton and the Democrats wore that badge.
Yeah, and I think in closing, it's important to recognize that the support for Kamala Harris among many progressives is very much tempered by her policies in alignment with Biden around supporting Israel and militarism. And so I think young people who lean to the left or are trying to find their place in the Democratic Party are less seduced than many Democrats in the 90s in the Clinton era. So there's hope for the future, I think, including within and beyond this campaign.
Right. And I think we recommend the film because it is a little bit of a romp through a campaign, and there's a lot that is funny, and you know, the ridiculousness of running a political campaign.
And we get to see Emma Thompson's endless varying hairstyles, which is always Hillary Clinton and her endlessly trying out different hairstyles. There's a lot of kind of poking fun in this film.
There is, you know, Kathy Bates' character is gay. She calls herself a gay lesbian woman. There's a lot of stuff in this. I mean, it's 1998. It's not like it was the dark ages, but it's still fun. And it also, I think, reminds us that things were not so great then for politics and for running a campaign, but that's nothing compared to what we're dealing with at the moment. The rancor and
the desperation of the right wing is another way of thinking about this. Just the very regressive sexual politics and displays of Trump and the troop that follows him around, I think is a symptom of a kind of decline of the right as well. So
yeah, the thrashing beast.
Yes, right.
Where we are at the moment.
Yeah, but we recommend the film. It's a kind of way to have a little respite.
Yeah. And Jan, thank you for inviting me to come back to the Old Mole for a moment, and we'll have to do this again.
Yeah, for sure.
This is Denise Morris. I'm with Jan Hocken this morning talking about the 1998 film Primary Colors.
That's Eddie Vedder following Jan Hocken and Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. And finally this hour, Patricia Kohlberg talking with Michaela McCormick about Extinction Rebellion PDX and their presentation of Outgrow the System, a new documentary about transitioning to more sustainable economic systems. That's in 2 weeks, Friday, November 15. Stay tuned for Patricia Kohlberg next for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Society, your crazy breed, I hope you're not lonely without me. Society, crazy indeed, I hope you're not lonely without me.
It's become increasingly clear that to save humanity from the worst of climate catastrophe, changes will need to be made in the ways that we live, and in particular, the ways that we produce, distribute, and consume goods and services. A new documentary called Outgrow the System, co-directed by Cecilia Paulson and Anders Nilsson, explores various alternative economic systems that would be sustainable and climate-friendly over the long term. Extinction Rebellion PDX is sponsoring a showing of the film on Friday, November 15th from 7 to 8 p.m., followed by a panel from 8 to 9. The showing will be held at PCC, the Cascade Campus, in the Moriarty Arts Building, 705 North Killingsworth. To talk about the documentary, I have with me today Michaela McCormick, who is a well-seasoned transgender woman and organizer with Extinction Rebellion here in Portland. She's been working for transformational change for 50 years, mostly on building structures and processes to address the many injustices we endure toward a more just, compassionate, and sustainable world. Good morning, Michaela, and welcome to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hello, thanks for having me, Patricia.
The movie, I believe, is based on the idea of economic degrowth. To begin with, could you explain to us a little bit about degrowth, what it is and why it matters?
Sure. In many ways, the term degrowth is pretty accurate in terms of what this concept is, but it's an unfortunate term because it turns a lot of people off. If you tell somebody I want to talk to you about degrowth, they say, I'm not interested in degrowth. So some of the things you said in your introduction are much more helpful in terms of developing alternative economic models. And those models, there are various names and versions for those. Sometimes it's called solidarity economy, participatory economy, well-being economy. And we find that it's much more helpful and hopeful to point to the models that this concept is looking toward, rather than calling it degrowth. We have to nuance that term because we're talking about degrowth mostly for the global north and for the wealthy and big corporations. Many, many people, if not most people in the global south, need more growth, sustainable growth, healthy growth, not the kind of growth that has happened in the global north, but they need growth. So part of it is shifting the resources from the global north to the global south.
So how are these ideas taken up in the film?
Well, they start by recognizing the climate crisis and the injustices that are perpetuated by it. But they soon go into discussion of these various models, solidarity economy, participatory well-being. One of the particular models is called donut economics, which is about finding a place for humans to exist on this earth that is situated and perpetuated between the limits of our climate, meaning not warming it, in fact, cooling it down from what it is, and our social needs, our needs for community, our needs for healthcare, education, all the basic needs. So they have a chart that shows the space in which humans could exist sustainably and justly is shaped like a donut between these two sets of limits and demands.
Now, would this donut, would it look different in different parts of the globe?
Yes, yes. Yeah, one of the reasons that they talk about different economic models is that they recognize that different ways of structuring an economy are going to work differently in different parts of the world. You know, so this is not a one-size-fits-all. This is an attempt to promote bottom-up development from in each locale and region, and to promote, along with the economics of it, local democratic governance, which again would be defined by the residents of that locale.
I think most people experience the current world economic order as something natural or immutable. So it always seems to me that circulating ideas about alternative systems, especially if they are concrete and doable, seems like a great idea.
A number of us in Extinction Rebellion here in Portland have been studying this concept of an alternative economy for the sake of the planet and all the species on Earth. And we happen to be all members of Extinction Rebellion, and we brought it to our organization and proposed that we make this a part of our ongoing analysis and vision. So we're now in the process of developing different strategies and how to build that concept and those longer term goals into our actions. And the city who has not lived up to its own climate emergency plan.
So you have ideas even about restructuring the local economic scene.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And some of that stuff is going on already. Like, there are lots of mutual aid efforts in Portland, as there are in many other cities around the world. And there are alternative food production, agricultural efforts. One of the organizations going to be represented on the panel discussion at the movie is called Black Owners Land Trust. And it's a group of Black people who have acquired some land and they're growing food for themselves and for others. Good food, organic food, sustainably grown at prices that people can afford. One of the reasons we wanted the panel discussion was to build our own relationships with those kinds of organizations. Extinction Rebellion, its specialty is nonviolent direct action against targets that are causing the problem, like Zenith Energy. So that's our specialty. We have not, to this point, as an organization, engaged in mutual aid or alternative economic models. But we want to be aligned with that and promote that because that's part of our vision.
So tell me who else is going to be on the panel that night?
We're probably going to have somebody from the Portland Clean Energy Fund, PCEF. Another organization we're probably going to include on the panel is Equal Exchange. They sell their foods that are grown from small cooperative farmers, mostly in the global south, that they have contracted with in all kinds of stores in this country, including New Season, Safeway. They started out with coffee and chocolate, but they've expanded now into a lot of other areas, not only in Latin America, where they began building cooperatives with small farmers there, but now in Africa. They have people in Palestine who grow olives that they distribute. And what's attractive about Equal Exchange is not only that they're bringing to market produce by small-scale cooperative farmers, their aim is not just to make money, but to build mutually beneficial relationships. So they have a practice of paying their farmers before they produce their food. And if they end up, for whatever reason, bad weather or whatever, they keep that money. And Equal Exchange swallows those losses. Mm-hmm. Equal Exchange as a company is also worker-owned.
Tell us again the details about the showing, where it is and the time.
Yeah, it's Friday, November 15th, showing at 7 to 8 p.m. with the panel from 8 to 9. And it's in the PCC Cascade campus in the Moriarty Arts Building. Our website is xrpdx.org. And if you want to go to information about this film, you type in events in the search space, and the first event listed on that events page is this film, Outgrow the System.
Thank you very much for being with us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're looking forward very much to seeing the film and appreciate hearing more about it.
Thanks for your time and interest.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for the 4th of November, 2024. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Patricia Kohlberg, Jan Hawken, Denise Morris, and Laurie Mercier, and to their guests Michaela McCormick and Juan Cole. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.